Screen addiction. It's hooking our kids, and it's very, very profitable.
So video games aren't addictive by accident. There's a lot of very smart people who are making these games as addicting to children as possible because of the financial agenda. This is a multi-billion dollar industry that's shooting fish in the barrel, and that's where I take offense to. That's what really bothers me, is that they're really manipulating our children in a way that's developmentally damaging.
That's addictions expert Dr. Nicholas Cardaris. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, on PRX, and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Screens are everywhere, and our kids are everywhere on them, and on them all the time. Whether it's tablets, phones, computers, video game consoles, or even TV, the blue screens are glowing in front of our kids' eyes an average of 9 hours a day. It's a gigantic, uncontrolled experiment that science is just beginning to understand the consequences of. The toll in mental health is sobering, from ADHD to Facebook-induced depression and anxiety to video game psychosis. But the impact on brain development is just as scary. Social skills are eroding. The ability to see, hear, and feel colors, sounds, and textures is becoming impoverished, and critical windows for brain development are being missed as kids inhabit most of their waking lives in the digital realm. Yet the appetite of schools and parents for more and more tech for their kids seems insatiable as they fall under the sway of the digital pushers, the tech industry. My guest, addictions expert Dr. Nicholas Cardaris, says screens are a kind of digital cocaine, hijacking the reward pathways of the brain just like other addictive substances. He explores a growing mountain of clinical research about this new addiction crisis in his book, Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. Nicholas Cardaris is an addictions expert and director of the Dunes, a rehab center in East Hampton, New York. I interviewed him at the Dunes. Dr. Nicholas Cardaris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
In your book, Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance, you say that we have made a Faustian bargain, and the price of that bargain is the soul of a generation. What do you mean by that?
Well, in my book, I talk about how when I was a youngster, I really looked forward to a future world where technology would sort of ease the travails of the human race. I was a Star Trek fanatic when I was a kid, and I really, really admired what that technological future represented for us. I was a science fiction devotee, so there was certain, especially in Star Trek, they really painted some of the benefits of a future peaceful world that had all these technological advances, and they painted less of a dystopian picture than I think may have actually emerged. And so I think now, as we've gotten closer to the reality of the technology of Star Trek, we're seeing that it's not without its price.
And the soul of a generation?
Well, I've worked with over 1,000 teenagers over the last 12 or 13 years, and I'm seeing a qualitative change in how they interact, how they are as beings in the world. And I correlate a lot of that fundamental shift in who they are as a byproduct of their technology immersion. It's fundamentally changed and impacted not just their educational growth, but their growth as young people. Everything from how they interpersonally interact to their sensory perception to their inquisitiveness. I found a lot of kids who are raised on a high-tech diet are more, I call them uninteresting and uninterested. They don't have that natural curiosity that a lot of us had in prior generations because they're so used to being hyper-stimulated that they need to be perpetually stimulated. And that doesn't lend itself to natural exploration and curiosity and looking up at the night sky or playing with a stick or those kinds of things that traditionally helped us explore our worlds and our own selves.
Yes, I was just reading today an article about Ursula K. Le Guin, the great science fiction writer, reminiscing about her own childhood where she and her siblings would create whole worlds and play act them out, write plays, write books. That's the kind of thing you never see kids doing these days.
That's, if I had to say singularly, probably the biggest damage that's happened. It's robbed our kids of their imagination because it's programmed them with imagery. I sometimes quote a quote that I love that I read from Graham Nash a few years ago. Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and they were very militantly against making music videos. This is back in the MTV days when almost every band started making music videos. And Graham Nash said, "We don't want to program our listeners with the imagery that they mentally see when they hear our songs. We want that to be their own innately created, we want them to make their own music videos in their minds." And I've thought about that because I was in college during the MTV generation, and when I think of a song that I've heard pre-MTV, my own memories, my own video reel plays out in my mind. And when I hear of a song that I've seen the music video for, it invariably pops into my head. And essentially, we're creating a generation of kids who we are programming their visual and imaginative content. And I think if imagination is anything like language or attention, it's a developmental window. And if you don't nurture imagination by, like you said, creating your own worlds or writing or when children free play together and use active imagination, do they lose that throughout their lifetime? We don't really know. What are these technology children, what are they going to look like when they're 30, 40, or 50 years old? We don't know. I think this is one huge experiment.
How much screen time are kids averaging today?
So the Pew Center was it was 7 hours for pre-teenagers and 11 hours for teenagers, and that's a combination of screen time in school and at home and television and phones and tablets and Chromebooks. So the average teenager spends more time on the screen than they do sleeping. You know, 11 hours a day is the vast majority of their waking life is spent in front of a glowing, radiant screen.
And that has its own problems, as we'll get into in a little bit. Now, people have been talking about the problems with screens ever since TV came along. How different is this from then? Because, I mean, after all, I grew up, you know, we got our first TV when I was 7, although I wasn't allowed to watch it very much, for which I'm very glad. But nonetheless, is this just overblown, or is there something different about the screens that our kids are subjected to today?
Yeah, that's what I get the most, and I like that question because I get that. Well, come on, this is just the latest generation of screen technology or any kind of technology. In my book, I talk about how Plato thought that the written word was going to be the end of us because it was going to atrophy our memory, because back then it was oral storytelling. So once people started writing things down, they were going to lose their ability to remember things, which there was some truth to, by the way. I quote also in my book, Neil Postman was an NYU professor who was the head of media communication at NYU in the mid-80s. And in 1985, he wrote a really seminal book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And he was pointing at television as being, he analogized television as being sort of the equivalent of Soma in Brave New World, that it was going to be this cultural drug that was going to create a societal malaise, and that we were all going to be essentially hypnotized pleasure seekers. And again, this was, and I thought it was fairly prophetic because this was 1985. And in 1985, you know, we're talking about Cheers and you know, whatever the popular shows were, you know, Dynasty. And he thought that that was going to be a cultural drug. And he also did imply that, like Soma, there was a political context to it, that it was a form of mass control, which I don't want to sound too conspiratorial, but I do think there's an aspect of that as well, because I've worked with a lot of young people who, when you are screen immersed, a lot of the young people I work with, they couldn't tell you who the president is. They couldn't tell you a lot of things that are happening on geopolitically because they're so focused on their little gadget. So in that sense, it sedates a generation. I think it keeps a generation distracted or sedated or whatever word we might want to use. But going back to television versus modern screens, so qualitatively they're different. Television, even though it may have had these problems that Neil Postman pointed out, was passive stimulation. I sit, I watch my television, and we do know that television has led to some attentional impacts, that there was some ADHD research by Dr. Dimitri Christakis in 1990 that looked at the effects of television on ADHD. And for every hour of screen time between the ages of 2 and 6 of television screen time, a child had a 10% higher rate of ADHD as it grew older. So if a 4-year-old watched 3 hours of television, he had a 30% higher rate of ADHD. In a 1990 rabbit ear television set, they redid that research in 2010 with tablets. Now, the two key distinguishing features of modern screens versus television are the interactive and immersive aspects of them. So because tablets are, as I said, immersive and interactive, the attentional effect is amplified. His research showed that those kids really develop attentional problems. But some of the other clinical disorders that I've researched and I've looked into are also amplified. And it's this idea that we're not physiologically equipped, especially at that age, to handle that level of stimulation, that level of immersion. What happens is if a child, let's say a 7 or 8 year old, is playing a video game, these video games are created to be so adrenaline surging, so dopamine activating. And before I get to the dopamine, I'll talk about the adrenaline piece. The game designers are, not only the game designers, but the neuroscientists that the game companies have hired, they're charged with making the games as exciting and as adrenaline surging, because that's what makes the games the most popular. They hire beta testing teenagers to play the first rounds of these games, and they hook up these teenagers to galvanic skin responses and blood pressure gauges. And if their blood pressure doesn't go to 180 over 140 within 3 minutes, they go back and tweak the intensity of the game. They combine that with what we call a variable reward ratio. Most games have a variable reward ratio, which is the same reward ratio that slot machines have. And that's the most compulsive kind of reward ratio. So video games aren't addictive by accident. There's a lot of very smart people who are making these games as addicting to children as possible because of the financial agenda. And in fact, there was a community of parents that was interested. There was an APA, American Psychological Association, job newsletter that was looking for psychologists to work for the gaming industry. And it talked about how, you know, the behavior modification and different tactics to help make these games as appealing and addicting as possible. This is a multi-billion dollar industry that's shooting fish in the barrel. And that's where I take offense to. That's what really bothers me, is that they're really manipulating our children in a way that's developmentally damaging. Attention is a developmental window, like language, that if a child doesn't develop their ability to focus during that key period of development, they become lifelong compromised attentional people. And think about it as adults, those of us who, if you watch any, think about watching an exciting movie for 2 hours. You're watching any kind of car chase kind of movie with a lot of explosions and sights and sounds. If you have your adrenaline racing, and you go into a fight or flight response when you watch something so stimulating, then try to sit still and read a book. Try to read War and Peace after you watch the car chase movie for 2 hours. As adults, we can't do it. Now picture a child who's playing edgy games or video games or stimulating themselves with social media for 7 to 11 hours a day. And I wonder why ADHD has increased by 20-fold. ADHD rates are up 20-fold. You know, people are scratching their heads trying to figure out why ADHD has grown in this epidemic level. It's obvious. It's this hyper-stimulated generation who now needs to perpetually be getting stimulated in order to focus.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dr. Nicholas Cardaris about his book, Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. This puts me in mind of a conversation I had just this past weekend with my 12-year-old granddaughter, who in third grade was a great reader and is now struggling to read, not because she doesn't know how to read, but as she said to me, I'm having trouble focusing. What happened in the meantime was that she got a phone. And she had, you know, was totally addicted to it until finally it was taken away from her several months ago. And she's just really recovering. But I think there is something she's noticed, that she cannot focus the way she used to on reading.
That's a perfect example of even moderate usage with quote-unquote normal children. And if it compromises your ability to focus, which it inevitably does. I've done a lot of work with Dr. Andrew Doan, as head of addiction research for the U.S. Navy, and the Pentagon asked him to research video game addiction. And he talks about how the hypothalamus, the HPA, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis.
Explain that.
So the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis is essentially our fight or flight response. And genetically, we're made as a survival adaptation to activate our HPA axis to go into fight or flight when under stress or duress. If a saber-toothed tiger was chasing us, we go into HPA activation, which surges adrenaline into our hands and feet so we can run or fight. What happens now is that video technology is creating a false threat and sending children into this fight or flight response hour after hour after hour, and we weren't designed to go into extended adrenal fight or flight response. We were designed to go into it for short bursts. And so what happens is, and Dr. Victoria Dunkley is an adolescent psychiatrist in Los Angeles who writes a lot about this and has become a friend and a colleague. Children who are in perpetual fight or flight response because they're getting stimulated by phones or by video games, they can't, their thermostat, their adrenal thermostat has been raised to high, and it's not easy to lower that thermostat. And so what does that look like? That looks like mood dysregulation. That looks like attentional problems. That looks like a behavioral disorders, because these kids are amped up and they can't, it's like having a few cups of Starbucks and then sit still all of a sudden. In her practice, she won't diagnose or prescribe any, you know, she's had 1,000 kids come to her practice over the last decade. And if a kid has a mood disorder, a behavioral disorder, even a spectrum disorder, she won't diagnose or prescribe until they've done a 4 to 6 week digital detox, reset their adrenal system, and then see if they're still presenting symptoms. And what she says in her book and what she says to me personally is that 60 to 65% of these children no longer have these troubling symptoms once they've unplugged for a few weeks, because their adrenal system resets itself and these other secondary symptoms aren't there anymore. And so the example that you gave with your granddaughter is a perfect example of somebody that was looking like they have an attentional problem, but it was really a byproduct of that electronic device.
Now, we've been talking about more or less normal kids and just problems with attention and some behavior. Early in your book, you give the example, really shocking example, of a kind of psychosis that develops. This kind of set you on your way with this. Tell us about the kid who came in to your office and was lost in a different world.
Yeah, that was my first aha moment, and it was about 10 years ago when I had a 16-year-old young man sent to my office who was very disoriented, blinking hard, looking around the room in a very confused state. And I kept asking him orienting kind of questions, where are you, what's your name? And he kept blinking, and then finally at the end of it he said, you know, are we still in the game? And he was a young man who had been playing World of Warcraft, a sort of a mythical archetypal game, for 10, 12 hours a day, and got lost in the matrix, as I like to say, and couldn't discern reality anymore. In psychiatry, we call that derealization, where you no longer know what's real and what's not. And we used to, in the old days, we used to see substance-induced derealization. Bad acid trips led people to derealization. And now, for the first time, I saw a young man who was having what we can call, effectively, a video game psychotic episode. And he had to go to a psychiatric hospital here locally in Long Island for a month, got put on antipsychotic medications, and had some troubles thereafter. since then, there's been a lot of research that's been done on that, and this is sort of an underappreciated aspect of what happens when you take young children and give them, not only are we hyperstimulating them, but we're blurring reality with this hyperrealism. Some of these games, you know, again, a little 12-inch black and white TV set from yesteryear is not the same as a 52-inch LCD screen with some of these very realistic images. Now, before I was talking about developmental windows, attention, language, the other thing that's a developmental window is reality testing. We psychologists call our ability to tell what's real and what's not a reality testing. And children develop a sense of what's real and what's not, usually through the ages of 6 and 10 years old, the sense of I'm real, that's real, that's solid, that's not. And if you, during that key developmental window, you start giving them Pokemon Go or holograms or virtual reality this or just even two-dimensional, good old two-dimensional video games, all of a sudden the child starts becoming confused as to what may be real and what cannot be real. The other part of it is it starts invading their psyche in a very powerful way. And so the two psychologists in England, Dr. Mark Griffiths and Dr. Rebecca De Gortari, they gave a name to this psychotic effect. They called it game transfer phenomenon, GTP. And game transfer phenomenon was when video gamers would start to hear or see aspects of the game even when they weren't playing the game. And so they studied 1,600 video gamers, and some of them hours, days, or weeks after the game would hear aspects of the game, they would see the game, they would hear shots or swords, swipes, or voices from the game. Some of the effects were milder, just, you know, voices in the sort of the back of your mind, and some of them were more pronounced, where people would actually see their, you know, characters of the game popping up in front of them. I worked with an 8-9-year-old who would start seeing the world in the Minecraft cube shapes. The game Minecraft, for those of you who don't know, is a bane of modern technology, because they're mistakenly calling it digital Lego, which it's not. But the game is in cube form, and some kids are beginning, they talk about that when they're dreaming or when they're sleeping, they see things in cube form, and when they wake up, this one child was seeing trees that were in the shape of cubes. Years ago, 10, 15 years ago, they called this the Tetris effect. Harvard studied it, and they looked at a handful of people that were suffering from the Tetris effect. And there was this older game called Tetris that had these little square cubes that you would... And that was a pretty basic two-dimensional game, but it had a very searing effect on the psyche. So people that had the Tetris effect talked about seeing the little tetraminos in their corners of their visual field. And some of them talked about seeing that for years. Now, the counter argument that I'll get is somebody will tell me, well, when I read a book, I'll also maybe see some of the characters in my mind's eye, or we go back to active imagination. I might imagine some of those things. And the same thing with television. If I've seen the TV show, I might have a character or a jingle in my head. And I think all that is true, though there is the potential for that. But what we're seeing is this immersive, interactive, hyper-real level of technology amplifies those effects to a degree that we've never seen in book. We don't see those types of effects by heavy book readers. We don't see those effects even by heavy television watchers, typically.
You know, it almost reminds me of PTSD in some ways. I almost wonder if it's activating the same kind of biological mechanisms that create flashbacks in people who've been traumatized.
I think there's two parts of that, right? I think PTSD and the fact that, right, so you're in this adrenal fight or flight response, so a lot of chronic gamers are hypervigilant and they're shaky. I've worked with a couple of gamers who were, you know, very easily startled, which you see in PTSD. And the imagery that you talk about in terms of flashbacks, to me, that reminds me also of psychedelic flashbacks. You know, where the imagery was so powerful, when somebody had an acid trip and they were seeing, you know, purple mushrooms and very powerful imagery, it sears itself into our subconscious sometimes. And we were talking off mic earlier about a young man that I'm working with in Texas, and he tells me today he's been off of his game for months now, and he can't get the imagery. Every day the images are in his head, every day, and then if he left that treatment program tomorrow, this is, you know, he's been there for over 2 months now, and it effectively destroyed a very successful life. I told you he was a straight A student and an all-state wrestling champion. He said, I would go to it in a minute. Just the compulsion, he said, he just really would like to play again. He felt he was really good at it, and it was just so hypnotic. He, like any drug addict, it's not a rational choice. You know, I work with a lot of addicts who are very bright oftentimes, and yet they'll do some very irrational things, because when they're in the throes of this addictive cycle, it's not a rational calculus. I said to the young man, well, you know, if you go back to playing, you're not going to get back into college. You're not going to have the life that you want to leave. You know, you're going to go right back into that basement world of, and he says, that's right. But all I could think about is that game.
Well, so talk about this, Nicholas Cardaris. Talk about the dopamine aspect of this, the addictive aspect. How does that work? And why is it so much like, in fact, the kind of addictive substances we're used to, like cocaine or heroin?
Well, I think most addiction is about escape. And I think in my book, I write about a young man who, you know, if your everyday reality is not that wonderful, I think most of us can understand, you know, why the abused child might want to escape in a drink or a drug or a video game. You know, in my book, I wrote about a young man who had he had disabled parents, and he had a really horrific home life. And it was a very filthy home with a lot of ferrets and animals. And it was a mildly Asperger's young man who came into school, and I still remember him. This sweet, blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy, and out of his shirt, two or three cockroaches fell out of his shirt and on his desk. And for the rest of his high school career, he became known as Roach Boy. Roach Boy. He was taunted, Roach Boy, Roach Boy. Now, this was a sweet, sensitive kid who had now become demonized because of his home life or his everyday reality. And when I was working with him, he became totally addicted and immersed in a game called Final Fantasy XIV, where he had an avatar that conquered worlds. And I got it. If I was Roach Boy, I think I might want to be. We understand there's a certain escape factor that I think virtual worlds offer, that drugs and alcohol offer, for those who have compromised psychological or home environment, home lives. But then neurochemically, what we talk about too is the games also have they affect the brain in the same way that an addictive substance does. People are shocked to hear that, because people think I have to ingest something for it to alter my brain chemistry. They don't realize that behavior can also change brain chemistry, but behavioral addictions like gambling, sex, can change brain chemistry. And so they've done probably over a dozen brain imaging research studies now that have shown that a brain on excessive screen time looks, the one in particular, the one study that was from the Indiana University School of Medicine, showed that gamers' brains change in almost exactly the same way as cocaine addicts do. Their frontal cortex gets compromised, and the frontal cortex is the executive functioning, the decision-making part of our brains, the impulse control part of our brains. And if you have a compromised impulse control, it's sort of a vicious cycle. I develop an addiction to something, and that addiction further damages that part of me that might allow me to just say no, as Nancy Reagan would say. And so we see that screens do that. So there's these studies that show that the gray matter in the frontal cortex shrinks, and also the white matter, which is the myelination, which is the connectivity of the brain. There's been research that shows that video games also create white matter abnormalities, which mimic parallel drug addiction abnormalities. These were shocking studies, and I was on Fox News and Friends a few weeks back, and they had the slides of those side-by-side brain imaging studies, and that shocks a lot of people, that this game can actually be affecting the brain in that way. The dopamine piece, that is, where there was the one study that, and it was an older study, it was 1998, it was Dr. Cope, K-O-E-P-P, K-O-E-P-P, right, Dr. Cope. And they looked at different substances and behaviors and how they affected dopamine levels in the brain through brain imaging. And they saw that chocolate and craving foods raised dopamine 50%, so, we can get a little addicted to chocolate. Sex and 1998 video games were 100% dopaminergic, dopamine activating. So a 1998 video game, which is, by the way, it's almost like our grandparents' video games compared to today's hyper-real video games, was as dopamine activating as a sexual experience. And then cocaine was about 300% dopamine activating. So while not quite the level of cocaine, it was as stimulating to the dopamine receptors as sex. And what I say is, well, as adults, we might be able to handle sexual experiences because we have fully developed frontal cortexes. So the frontal cortex is also called our braking mechanism. Children don't have a fully developed frontal cortex. That doesn't develop till your early 20s, which is why teenagers bungee jump and ride motorcycles without helmets and have unprotected sex because they don't consequentially think the way adults do. They don't do if-then thinking. So, but yet we're giving these kids a digital brain orgasm, essentially, and then we're saying, but only do it for half an hour. And they don't have the neurological apparatus to control that impulse.
Nicholas Cardaris. His book is Glow Kids: How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. We'll talk more after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today on an issue that should concern every parent, and indeed all of us: the growing evidence that the dominance of digital tech in our children's lives is threatening their mental, emotional, and even sensory development. And it's causing an addiction crisis that science is just beginning to understand. Our guest today is Dr. Nicholas Cardaris, author of Glow Kids: How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance. Before the break, we talked about video games and a kind of video game psychosis that's showing up. But social media can also have disturbing impacts on the mental health of kids. We've been talking about video games, but as you point out in this book, Glow Kids, the same kind of dopamine effect is seen with social media, something that girls are far more likely to get into, whereas boys are more likely to get into video games. Talk about social media and how that mimics what happens with the video game scenario.
Well, it really is in the digital world. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. There is a gender divide in digital preferences. Not absolute, but the pattern tends to be that boys tend to gravitate towards video games. And I would suppose that that's an adrenaline, aggression, testosterone thing. And girls, because of their more social collectivist aspect, gravitate towards social media. But social media and texting and all those, there was the research at Case Western Reserve that looked at the effects of what were called hypertexters and hypernetworkers. And hypernetworkers were people who were on social media more than 3 hours a day, which, by the way, is light by most teenage standards today. And hypertexters were people who were texting over 150 times a day, which, again, is light by most teenager standards today. I think that research was 2010, 2012. I think they'd have to keep changing those numbers as they go along. But anyway, hypernetworkers and hypertexters correlated with a lot of other unpleasant behavioral problems. Kids that were hyper texters and hyper networkers had higher rate. They did more poorly in school. They had more behavioral outbursts. They had more sexual partners. They had higher incidence of mental health issues like depression, anxiety. And that's the big one. That's the thing that I think people underappreciate about social media. We are social animals. We're hardwired to socially connect. That's part of our DNA. And so it was this sort of, I think, a misnomer that, well, social media for social animals has to be kind of a, that should be wonderful, right? We're finding an outlet to connect. And yet what seems to be happening is it's not it doesn't seem to fit our genetic need for real human contact. A digital Facebook friend is not the same as a flesh and blood friend. And Johan Hari, the author of Chasing the Scream, it's an addiction book, he talks about social media. He does a TED Talk where he talks about social media seems to be a counterfeit social connection. And in fact, the Facebook research shows, and there's a phenomenon called Facebook depression, the more Facebook friends you have, the higher likelihood of that you have depression.
And why?
So they attribute that to something called the social comparison effect. In addition to the fact that the more Facebook friends you have, then perhaps you might have less fresh flesh and blood friends. But Facebook leads to Facebook depression because of the social comparison effect, which essentially means that people tend to put their best faces on Facebook. You know, you tend to not post a picture of yourself depressed on a Friday afternoon. You tend to post your happy vacation photos. And so it's our best outside selves. And if, let's say, you or I are going through a rough week and, you know, we pop on the computer and we start scrolling through our news feed and we start seeing happy vacation photo here, wonderful kids there, and I'm having a rough day that day, it amplifies my sense of maybe my life's not so wonderful. And so that's one aspect, the social comparison effect. But the other, I think, more significant aspect is it deludes us into thinking that we have a social connection when we don't. And we desperately need flesh and blood contacts. I talk about in my book, the Dunbar number. Dr. Dunbar was an anthropologist that looked at primate groupings. And he found that primates and human beings were very similar in how we cluster and how we socialize. And primates could have up to about 75 acquaintances, or, you know, in their little tribal units, but they needed to have between 3 and 5 close interpersonal in their more immediate family or core cluster. And human beings are the same way. It seems that we need to have 3 to 5 close friends, you know, the 3 a.m. friends. You know, if the S hits the fan at 3 a.m., you're not going to call your Facebook friend. You know, you're going to need that flesh and blood person that you've made eye contact with, that you know. And that seems to be disappearing in the Facebook age, the flesh and blood relationships. Dr. Dunbar also talked about grooming itself, the touch was important, that actually he found that when primates, the grooming rituals were, there was a hygiene component about it, but it was more an endorphin-releasing touch bonding aspect.
Oxytocin too.
Yeah, the oxytocin, the love neurotransmitter, and obviously that can't happen digitally. We lose, and I'm not saying to indiscriminately go touching people, but our close friends, there's, you know, the pat on the back, the hand on the knee, the eye contact. There was an interesting research about the eye contact. There was research that showed that for interaction between two human beings to have the phrase that was used was meaningful social and emotional resonance. Eye contact needed to be maintained 60 to 70% of the time. And teenagers today are maintaining eye contact 20 to 30% of the time. This decreased ability to maintain eye contact is a direct byproduct of their technology usage. And if it's compromising their eye contact in their real life situations, and if they need that eye contact to have genuine social bonds, it's doing that level of damage. We could almost look at this onion through so many different layers of impact that it has. And I think so often it's just swept under the rug as just a digital babysitter or just kind of like television. But yet it's so, so much. You and I are both of an age where we remember life before. It's really been 10 years, only in the last 10 years, that we have seismically shifted how we are as human beings. And yet evolutionarily, we're still in hunter and gatherer bodies. And we are not, our technology has far outpaced our evolution in terms of what we need as human beings and how we need to be. And that's why I work in the mental health field. We're seeing explosions of anxiety disorders and addiction disorders and all these other kinds of, our industrialized, digitized world has lent itself to a lot of these issues. I mean, not to go off on a tangent, but I do a group here later where...
And we are in your rehab facility.
We're at the Dunes. And I show some of the work of Dr. Ilardi, who wrote a book called The Depression Cure a few years ago, and who looked did a cross-cultural analysis of different cultures and found that certain cultures had no rates of depression, zero rates of depression, mostly indigenous types of cultures. But and one anthropologist spent 10 years with the Papua New Guinea, 2,000 Papuans, and there was only one Papuan who in 10 years showed some signs of clinical depression. And he must have been the real life of the party for the New Guineans. But and what they found was it was lifestyle. Certain lifestyles lend themselves to, and Dr. Lardy developed his therapeutic lifestyle protocol, that it was, they were much more, they had a collectivist culture, so they were socializing more. They were much more physically active. They were getting more sunlight. They were getting more omega-3. Those were the natural antidepressants. The Papuans had a very difficult life. The survival was a struggle. It's not as if they were sitting in hammocks and peeling grapes to each other, but yet they weren't depressed. And yet we have epidemic levels of, by the World Health Organization says depression is going to be our number two health crisis by the year 2020. We're a profoundly depressed society as we seem to get more digitally connected, which shouldn't be the case. And I'm arguing that we're getting more and more isolated, more and more disconnected, more and more unhealthy lifestyle patterns as a result of this technological boom that we're living in.
And Dr. Karderas, Nicholas Karderas, in this book, Glow Kids, you also talk about the impact on empathy.
Well, again, it's going to developmental windows. Empathy also is something that gets developed. And children that have attachment disorder usually something that happens to kids who don't get appropriately nurtured. And there are things called mirror neurons in the brain that help us have empathy. And some sociologists say that what defines human beings from the animal kingdom is our language and our empathy. And empathy does seem to get compromised by the desensitization of some of the screen technology. And there was some research that showed that avatar-based screen worlds desensitize not only the violence aspect of it, but we don't develop these healthy eye contact human interconnections.
And even sensory awareness is lessened.
Yeah, that's another one that's greatly underappreciated. I talk about the work of Marcia McCulloch, who looked at indigenous cultures. And well, let me back up. In Germany, at the University of Tübingen, they had looked at sensory awareness over the last 40 years. And we were losing sensory awareness at a rate of 1% a year. And that was since the advent of the color television set. So we were getting sensorially desensitized by the more stimulation we got. And that only, I think, makes sense. The more you get bombarded by sights and sounds and colors and bells and whistles, the more it deadens our sensory awareness of that. And Marcia McCulloch looked at these indigenous cultures, and she found that kids in South America and aboriginal types of cultures, they had a 30% higher rate of sensory awareness. They were more acute. Their senses were more tuned in. They saw more colors, heard more sounds, and when put in a traditional school setting, were much sharper, were better students by twofold, she had found. So their minds were sharper. They weren't dulled and deadened by the bang, boom, pow of all this noise that we've been bombarding our kids with.
Yes, and now this brings us to another very important section of your book, Glow Kids, Nicholas Karderas, and that is about the whole digital, educational, tell us the term, complex. It's one of those complexes.
The educational industrial complex and the entrepreneurs who are capitalizing off of said complex. Yeah, education technology is a $60 billion a year industry globally. And so there's big money to be had in screens in the classroom and everything from smart boards to Chromebooks to tablets to phones. And so what's happening is an assumption's been made without any research that somehow the more technology in the classroom somehow leads to better educational outcomes. And there's no research that proves that. And yet that assumptions, that narrative has been sold to school districts and to municipalities and who have invested millions and billions of dollars into tech. And it's become an emperor has no clothes phenomenon. and keeping up with the Joneses. So school district X wants to keep up with school district Y. They've given tablets to the middle school, but now we're going to give them to the elementary school because we're going to be more advanced. Where we know that the people who are the designers and the inventors of technology are the most tech-cautious parents. We know that Steve Jobs didn't give his youngest children iPads. There was a famous New York Times interview in 2010 where he talked about not giving his kids iPads when the interviewer said to him, "Oh, your kids must be thrilled that, your house must be, iPads must be raining from the sky." And his biographer talked about at dinner time, there was no technology in Steve Jobs's house. They would talk about politics or culture or the world. And we know that in Silicon Valley, where all the Yahoo and Google engineers work and live, a good number of them send their children to non-tech Waldorf schools. And that was also in the New York Times. And when they interviewed some of these parents, they said, develop our kids' brains first. And then once they had developed brains or more fully along, then we expose them to technology. This notion, this false notion that parents have that their children will be behind the technological eight ball if they're not coding by in the womb or if they don't have a tablet, in utero, is preposterous. And the one parent who was a Google engineer said, "We make this stuff so it's idiot-proof. Adults can pick it up like that." So a child who's not on the tablet at age three isn't behind his peers. But well-meaning and well-educated parents have fallen for that. And part of that is that the schools, since the schools are pumping out the technology, it gives parents the sense that, well, it can't be that bad for them. But what we see is that there was the $1.3 billion iPad fiasco in Los Angeles 2 years ago.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so John Deasy, who was the superintendent in LA, we have a mutual friend, Pedro Nogueira, who's a very well-known educator. He's at UCLA now, and he's by all accounts, a well-intentioned guy. John Deasy, I think, was trying to do right by the children of Los Angeles, 650,000 students, and he felt that technology would level the playing field. He believed in that there was economic disparities, and why shouldn't the poorer kids have what the rich kids have? So let's level the playing field by giving all these kids iPads. So he was a bit of an ideologue, and he convinced the school board, and they signed a $1.3 billion contract with Apple and Pearson, because of course it had to have the educational software goodies that were Common Core goodies packed inside. And within a few weeks, the FBI raided their business offices. It's under federal investigation that it wasn't bid properly. There was financial improprieties. And some of the wiretaps indicate that not that Deasy profited from it, but that he was essentially, he had been wined and dined and sort of corrupted by the reps of the tech companies. And so now all those iPads were put into storage. The Pearson software was underdeveloped and only at Duke grade levels. It was a boondoggle, and the whole thing has now been scrapped. And LA is suing to get their money back. Even worse, I think, is in New York City, with the Joel Klein, Rupert Murdoch unholy alliance. Joel Klein, the former New York City schools chancellor from 2001 to 2011, making a decent $225,000 a year, gets hired by Rupert Murdoch for $2 million a year with a $1 million signing bonus. I didn't know that quasi-educators had $1 million signing bonuses, but Joel Klein was a Harvard lawyer. He'd never been in a classroom before, but Rupert Murdoch wanted to cash in on what he saw as this educational gold rush. He's, Rupert Murdoch, I don't want to get political, but he's not known for his concern for the educational content of our children, but he needed a front man. He needed needed somebody with some academic bona fides or some school bona fides. And so Joel Klein gets hired, and they invested, or Rupert Murdoch invested, $1 billion in this company called Amplify. And their narrative was that kids don't have the attention span for traditional education. We're going to make a common tablet, and we're going to sell that to every kid in America. And they had hired 650 video game designers in a warehouse in Brooklyn, and they spent all day long creating what were called edgy games, because kids can't pay attention to traditional Socratic circles or talking or classroom education. And so they were going to bell and whistle and edgy game the classroom. Luckily, it crashed and burned. They didn't get the traction that they wanted, but it was not through any lack of trying. But it's this idea that gamifying the classroom is somehow going to be better, where the gold standard countries like Finland, who are at the top of the educational hierarchy, have flatly rejected school technology. Their Minister of Education has said there has been no evidence that this is beneficial, and we're going to put more money into the teachers.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's well known among teachers and pedagogy that it's the relationship between the teacher and the student that is really what's involved in learning.
Exactly. Dr. Kantaro was, he was at the University of Michigan, and he had went to India back in 2004 working for Microsoft, and he had went there with the idea that he thought that in underdeveloped country like India, maybe technology can be the great equalizer in terms of helping education. And he came away, disappointed that he saw that wasn't the case. And he called it the law of amplification, that technology in well-funded, well-developed schools with wonderful educators can have a benefit at the upper grade levels. But just throwing technology at poor districts or unsupported districts, it amplifies what's bad. And so technology could be damaging, it could be hurtful. The University of Durham did a meta study on 48 education research studies about the role of technology, and they found that technology was less effective than other interventions that have evidence-based interventions behind them. And so it was really, I think, an infatuation that we, and I'll say we as a culture, got with the shiny new thing, that this somehow could be the panacea. I think some people jumped at the financial opportunities thereof. And my concern is that, well, Paula Poundstone is a screen-free advocate, and she talks openly about the issues that she's had with her son and technology. But she's been trying to lobby with politicians about screens in the classroom, and she was talking to Barbara Boxer, Senator Boxer in California, and her chief of staff. And she said, we've got to get these screens out of the classroom. We've got to get these screens out of the classroom. And Barbara Boxer's chief of staff said, well, we need more NIH research to get these screens out of the classroom. And Paula Poundstone said to him, shouldn't we have done the research before we put them into the classroom? We just sort of made an assumption that these things were somehow beneficial. And to me, I call them clinical Trojan horses. We've allowed these Trojan horses into the classroom, into our houses, and now we're seeing the ADHD epidemics, the tech addiction, the anxiety, the depression, all these clinical disorders that have been unleashed upon us under the pretense of educational.
Exactly. Now, we haven't even touched on the whole issue of violence and these screens. You have a whole chapter devoted, which I found very fascinating, to Adam Lanza, the killer at the Newtown Elementary School. And we don't have time to do that because before we end, I'd like to talk about what can we do. First, individually, you know, what advice would you give to a parent who's now, you know, gotten religion after listening to this broadcast and wants to do something to help protect their kids from this?
Prevention is worth a pound of cure. Having worked with kids who have fallen into the digital rabbit hole, I can tell you it's really hard to undo tech addiction once it's happened. I've said in other interviews that I find it easier to treat a heroin addict than I do a kid who's fallen into the digital rabbit hole, because we have clinical protocols about how to treat drug and alcohol addiction, and a person can be abstinent from drugs and alcohol. But once you've crossed that point where you can't have a healthy relationship with technology, and then it's so ubiquitous, it's really, really, really challenging. So I always try to say, catch it when it's early, and try to wait as long as possible before you expose your kids to screens. If you can bite the bullet till they're 10, Victoria Dunkley recommends 12, I say 10, and it's somewhere between 10 and 12. If you can keep kids relatively screen-free. Now, I have 9-year-old twins. We started letting him watch, we would get old episodes of I Love Lucy, you know, kind of older, slower, or Mr. Rogers, God bless him, Mr. Rogers was wonderful, slow moving. And we'd let them watch some things like that over when they were 8, but certainly no computer. And so I asked parents to be really cautious at the age of onset, the age of exposure to screens. In my book, I have a tech opt-out letter that every parent can give to their school administrator if their schools are trying to force a screen down their kid's throat at an early age. The letter has a link to my website, which has all the research, and so that's as ammunition. I'm working with a mother now, and her son is a kindergartner, 5, and they were forcing the kindergartners to have tablets. And she said, I don't want my child to have a tablet. She gave them my book. She fought. She went in front of the school board. She did a whole thing. And the principal, and she said, if you give him a screen, I'm going to pull him out of the school. And the principal threatened her with CPS, actually threatened her with CPS. She gave him my parent opt-out letter. And the principal, God bless his lack of intelligence, said, well, if we let your son opt out of screens, what if a parent wants to opt out of pen and paper? Then what? Then where will we be? Which makes absolutely no sense. And as a matter of fact, I'm having a conference call with that superintendent tomorrow to advocate for this mother's rights to have her child educated in the traditional manner. And I think that's my suggestion to parents. We have a voice if we organize. And I'm getting daily, I'm getting emails from communities of parents. There was a group in Marin County which formed their own school cooperative, which rejected screens entirely and pulled their kids out of the public schools. And I think if enough of that happens, and if educators begin to see that there's pushback from the parents, that we're getting more educated about some of these effects, then we could maybe affect some change in terms of what schools are doing and with screens in schools. Maryland right now, I'm in touch with a school group there. They're passing legislation right now about limiting screen time in all schools in Maryland. So there's been some movement now in terms of the emperor has no clothes, and let's slow the tide of this phenomenon that which has swallowed up this generation that we talk about.
Well, Nicholas Cardaris, that I'm glad we can end on a hopeful note. I think your book, Glow Kids, is absolutely required reading for parents and educators alike. How screen addiction is hijacking our kids and how to break the trance. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. Great to be with you.
Nicholas Cardaris. Cardaris is an addiction expert and director of the Dunes, a rehab center in East Hampton, New York. He's a frequent contributor to Psychology Today and has appeared on the CBS Evening News, NPR, and elsewhere. Read an excerpt from Glow Kids and other articles by Cardaris about how screens are addicting our kids at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.